book of the month. More than a podcast, greater than a radio show, quite simply an audio treat for the enlightened with Jill Appleton and Jill Prowse, and every so often, some extremely lovely writers.
For November's book of the month, we decided to give a novel by Jeffrey Archer a try. The title of the book is Only Time Will Tell, and is the first in a series charting the life of Harry Clifton. The story begins in 1920, prior to Harry's birth, where we are introduced to his mother, Maisie. Maisie comes from a close working-class family and is engaged to a docker named Arthur Clifton. Shortly after their son, Harry, is born, Arthur disappears in mysterious circumstances at the docks, leaving Maisie to bring up her son alone. As a young boy, Harry hates going to school and would rather spend his days hanging around the dockyards. It is there that he meets old Jack Tar, an old war hero who takes him under his wing. Harry does have a talent that makes up for anything he lacks academically, and that is his beautiful voice. When his extraordinary gift is discovered, he is plucked for a scholarship at a fancy prep school, and with the help of old Jack and his teachers, Harry's life takes a different direction as he joins the realms of the upper class at St. Bede's.
I was thrilled when I saw Harry walk through the school gates on the first day of term. I'd spent the summer halls at our villa in Tuscany, so I wasn't in Bristol when Tilly's was burnt to the ground, and didn't find out about it until I returned to England the weekend before term began. I had wanted Harry to join us in Italy, but my father wouldn't hear of it. I've never met anyone who didn't like Harry, with the exception of my father, who won't even allow his name to be mentioned in the house. I once asked Mama if she could explain why he felt so strongly, but she didn't seem to know any more than I did. I didn't press the point with my old man, as I've never exactly covered myself in glory in his eyes. I nearly got myself expelled from my prep school for stealing. Heaven knows how he managed to fix that, and after that I let him down by failing to get into Eton. I told Papa when I came out of the exam that I couldn't have tried harder, which was the truth. Well, half the truth. I would have got away with it if my co-conspirator had only kept his mouth shut. At least it taught me a simple lesson. If you make a deal with a fool, don't be surprised when they act foolishly. My co-conspirator was the Earl of Bridport's son, Percy. He was facing an even greater dilemma than I was, because seven generations of Bridports had been educated at Eton, and it was looking as if young Percy was going to ruin that rather fine batting average. Eton has been known to bend the rules when it comes to members of the aristocracy, and will occasionally allow a stupid boy to darken its doors, which is why I selected Percy for my little subterfuge in the first place. It was after I overheard the Frob saying to another beak, "If Bridport was any brighter, he'd be a half-wit," that I knew I didn't need to look any further for my accomplice. Percy was as desperate to be offered a place at Eton as I was to be rejected, so I saw this as no more than an opportunity for both of us to achieve our purpose. I didn't discuss my plan with Harry or Deakins. Harry would undoubtedly have disapproved. He's such a morally upright fellow, and Deakins wouldn't have been able to understand why anyone would want to fail an exam. On the day before the examination was due to take place, my father drove me to Eton in his swish new Bugatti, which could do 100 miles an hour, and once we hit the A4 he proved it. We spent the night at the Swan Arms, the same hotel in which he had stayed over 20 years before when he took the entrance exam. Over dinner, Papa didn't leave me in any doubt how keen he was that I should go to Eton, and I nearly had a change of heart at the last moment, but I had given my word to Percy Bridport, and felt I couldn't let him down. Percy and I had shaken hands on the deal back at St. Bede's, agreeing that when we entered the examination hall, we would give the recorder the other's name. I rather enjoyed being addressed as My Lord by all and sundry, even if it was only for a few hours. The examination papers were not as demanding as the ones I'd sat a fortnight earlier for Bristol Grammar, and I felt I'd done more than enough to ensure that Percy would be returning to Eton in September. However, they were difficult enough for me to feel confident that his lordship would not let me down. Once we'd handed in our papers and reverted to our true personas, I went off to tea with my pa in Windsor. When he asked me how it had gone, I told him I'd done the best I possibly could. He seemed satisfied by this and even began to relax, which only made me feel more guilty. I didn't enjoy the journey back to Bristol and felt even worse when I got home and my mother asked me the same question. 10 days later, I received an "I'm sorry to have to inform you" letter from Eton. I had only managed 32%. Percy scored 56% and was offered a place for the Michaelmas term, which delighted his father and was met with incredulity by the Frobe. Everything would have worked out just fine if Percy hadn't told a friend how he'd managed to get into Eton. The friend told another friend, who told another friend, who told Percy's father. The Earl of Bridport, M.C., being an honourable man, immediately informed the headmaster of Eton. This resulted in Percy being expelled before he'd even set foot in the place. If it hadn't been for a personal intervention by the Frobe, I might have suffered the same fate at Bristol Grammar. My father tried to convince the headmaster of Eton that it was simply a clerical error, and that, as I'd actually scored 56% in the exam, I should be reinstated in Bridport's place. This piece of logic was rejected by return of post, as Eton wasn't in need of a new cricket pavilion. I duly reported to Bristol Grammar School on the first day of term.
Life in his new surroundings does not come without its problems, but fortunately for Harry, he meets and befriends two companions who are going to influence his future life. One of these is Giles Barrington, son of a wealthy businessman and owner of the docks where Harry's father died. When Harry meets Hugo Barrington for the first time, it is obvious that Hugo hates Harry on sight, and this leads to plenty of underhand scheming and intrigue as he plots to rid Harry from his son's life.
Old Jack was disappointed to miss Harry's performance in the school play and had to be satisfied with being told the boys' version of how he had performed. The following year, when Holcomb suggested that perhaps old Jack should attend because Harry's roles were getting bigger, he nearly gave in. But it wasn't until Harry played Puck a year later that he finally allowed the dream a reality. Although he was still fearful of large crowds, old Jack had decided that he would slip into the back of the school hall where no one would see him or, even worse, recognise him. It was while he was trimming his beard in the fifth-floor washroom of Barrington House that he noticed the screaming headline in the copy of the local rag that someone had left behind. "Tilly's Tea Shop Burnt to the Ground. Arson Suspected." When he saw the photograph below it, he felt sick. Mrs. Clifton was standing on the pavement, surrounded by her staff, surveying the burnt-out remains of the shop. "Turn to page 11 for full story." Old Jack obeyed the instruction, but there was no page 11. He quickly left the washroom, hoping to find the missing page on Miss Potts's desk. He wasn't surprised to find that her desk was clear and her waste paper basket had been emptied. He tentatively opened the door to the managing director's office, looked inside, and spotted the missing page laid out on Mr. Hugo's desk. He sat down in the high-backed leather chair and began to read. Jack's immediate reaction once he'd finished was to wonder if Harry would have to leave school. The report noted that unless the insurance company paid the full amount on her premium, Mrs. Clifton would be facing bankruptcy. The reporter went on to say that a spokesman for the Bristol and West of England had made it clear that the company wouldn't be paying out a brass farthing until the police had eliminated all suspects from their inquiries. What else could possibly go wrong for the poor woman? Old Jack wondered. The reporter had been careful not to refer to Maisie by name, but old Jack wasn't in any doubt why her photograph was so prominently displayed on the front page. He continued to read the article. When he discovered that Detective Inspector Blakemore was in charge of the case, he felt a little more hopeful. It wouldn't take that particular gentleman long to work out that Mrs. Clifton built things up. She didn't burn them down. As old Jack placed the newspaper back on Mr. Hugo's desk, he noticed a letter for the first time. He would have ignored it, none of his business, if he hadn't seen the name Mrs. Clifton in the first paragraph. He began to read the letter and found it hard to believe it was Hugo Barrington who had put up the £500 that had made it possible for Mrs. Clifton to purchase Tilly's. Why would he want to help Maisie, he wondered. Was it possible he felt some remorse about the death of her husband? Or did he feel ashamed that he had sent an innocent man to prison for a crime he had not committed? Certainly he had given Tancock his old job back the moment he was released. Old Jack began to wonder if he should perhaps give Hugo the benefit of the doubt. He recalled Sir Walter's words. "He's not all bad, you know." He read the letter once again. It was from Mr. Prendergast, the manager of the National Provincial Bank, who wrote that he had been pressing the insurance company to fulfil its contractual obligations and recompense Mrs. Clifton for the full value of the policy, which was £600. Mrs. Clifton, Prendergast pointed out, was the innocent party, and Detective Inspector Blakemore had recently informed the bank that she no longer played any part in his inquiries. In the final paragraph of his letter, Prendergast suggested that he and Barrington should meet in the near future to resolve the matter so that Mrs. Clifton could receive the full amount she was entitled to. Old Jack looked up when the little clock on the desk chimed 7 times. He switched off the light, ran into the corridor and down the stairs. He didn't want to be late for Harry's performance.
The story is told from several viewpoints. Harry, his mother Maisie, Hugo, Old Jack Tar, Giles Barrington and his sister Emma. There are plenty of twists and turns. The storytelling is fast-paced, easy to read, and the plot is easy to follow. Basically, this is a fight between right and wrong and good and bad. The book ends on a real cliffhanger when Harry arrives in America only to be arrested for murder. I found this an enjoyable read and I'm looking forward to Volume 2, which should be available in 2012.
From Southside to the world. In association with Middlesbrough Library Services, it's The Book of the Month with Jill Appleton.
Did you know many motor insurers are owned by the same few parent companies?
No, nor did I until I spoke to personal injury solicitor Charles Arthur.
The aim of these big companies is to minimise costs by negotiating a knock-for-knock agreement or pushing you to settle quickly for a minimum payout.
So if you have an accident, you may be better off choosing an independent solicitor who acts only for you.
Of course, but then you'd expect me to say that, wouldn't you?
Call Middlesbrough 222 575 or text advice to 81400 now. Choose the one.
Farmer Nord is the chemist to call for your nutritional needs. All of our products have been built on scientific research to help with your health. Farmer Nord can even help in such areas as senile dementia, strokes, and Alzheimer's. All our products are made in accordance with pharmaceutical standards and guidelines. And all our products are just one call away. Call Farmer Nord on 01670 519989. That's 01670 519989. Or visit farmernord.co.uk. Farmer Nord, winning the war of nutrition.
With over 80 ensuite bathrooms and high-quality care for residents, provided 24/7 by qualified nurses and carers, Roseville Care Centre provides the perfect home for residents' emotional, spiritual, social, physical and intellectual needs.
A purpose-built residential care facility in the heart of Ingleby Barwick, Roseville is a care centre which provides facilities to accommodate residential elderly, EMI and nursing service users, offering both short and long-stay accommodation, as well as respite and daycare.
To find out more, please telephone 01642 30 81 88 or email us at info@rosevillecarecentre.com.
Roseville Care Centre. Care to call us home.
When you're living with cancer, the good days really matter. The day you get some answers about your treatment, or about benefits, or whatever's on your mind. You can take the first step towards more good days by calling Macmillan Cancer Support. Call 0808 808 0000 or visit macmillan.org.uk.
When you suffer a road accident that's not your fault, it's easy to be persuaded to go along with your insurer's recommendations. But I spoke to personal injury expert Charles Arthur about that.
In my opinion, Phrases like, you have free legal cover with this policy, are meaningless. If the accident wasn't your fault, you've nothing to pay anyway. I think what your insurer may mean is, but we've already sold your claim.
And if I don't want to be sold, can I choose my own solicitor?
Of course. It's your right to choose what's best for you. Choose the one you know.
Text CLAIM to 81400 now.
From Southside to the world, and in association with Middlesbrough Library Services, it's the Book of the Month with Jill Appleton.
Okay, so the time has arrived now where we need to actually turn to one of our key reporters, reviewers, etc., in a sort of session where actually it has to be said Rob Nichols has not even completed reading the book. He's had to actually step aside from the Geoffrey Archer piece in this particular instance. So thankfully, at least via telephone, we can at least say, Jill Prowse, what did you make of Only Time Will Tell?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was exactly what it said on the back of the book. It was a good yarn. I did feel like he's writing another Cain and Abel, all ready for the silver screen, and it had that feel of sort of a screenplay to me, but it kept you interested. I enjoyed the story of Harry, and I did think that he built the characters rather well. I liked old Jack. I liked the little characters like Miss Monday, the singing coach, or Miss Tilly, the tea shop owner. So, yeah, I enjoyed it.
Interesting. I mean, I think the cinematic approach is very much there. Did you not think it was at times a little bit stereotypical that, as you said, you can go back to not a penny more, not a penny less, and all sorts of things?
Alex. I mean, it was very sort of, it was exactly what it was. It was a yarn. It was, the characters were either whiter than white or blacker than black. But I didn't mind it. And I must admit, when I sort of thought, oh, Geoffrey Archer, I wasn't particularly looking forward to it that much, but it kept my interest.
Defined very much as unput downable, a page turner, etc. I think that might be over egging the pudding slightly in terms of this, but very much featuring that cliffhanger ending, which doesn't give too much away, but there is one of those things, and I think it's possibly the first time we've used this in the Book of the Month, where you just think, shall we go and purchase the sequel?
I know, I must admit, when I got to the end, I thought, oh, no. And I thought, I'll have to read it, because I'll have to find what happens to Harry.
It was either that, or it was clearly going to be a case of, well, you know, there was going to be one heck of a plot resolution in the last few pages, really, because it was opening up a whole range of things there. OK, Jill, we've got to ask you that question then. You know the usual thing in terms of scores and highlights. I'm nailing my colours to the mast for this one. Because of the formulaic nature, because of a variety of other things that we saw within that whole thing, I'm going to go 7.5.
I'm going to give it an 8.
Well, there we are. Yeah, sorted through that. Jill, as ever, we salute you and we'll see you back in the studio, hopefully for the next Book of the Month, presumably our festive special.
Excellent. Bye now.
The story continues in The Sins of the Father, Volume 2 of the Clifton Chronicles, published March 2012. Jill Appleton, I think that's just the first Book of the Month that actually finishes with a cliffhanger.
Literally. Yeah.
I suppose it's just as well if he'd actually put them both together, which he probably has. It would be a huge novelty. He could have killed somebody with the whole thing, quite literally. So we heard Jill Prowse there, her views, or given the marks. I've already sort of flagged up the whole thing. I'm almost tempted to say Geoffrey Archer is a bit like ABBA, really, insofar as there was a time when it was deeply uncool to even admit to liking anything that Geoffrey Archer wrote, although his books were always very successful. I remember the first time, I think, Channel 4 put together First Among Equals, which was the first of his novels to televisual adaptation of the novel, etc., was put together, as far as I recall. And I don't know. I mean, as I said in the discussion I was having with Jill there, I couldn't possibly go along with the Mail on Sunday's line, probably the greatest storyteller of our age.
No.
Because I think there are others who possibly might just be merited a slightly more important line of the whole thing. Did I enjoy it? I found it interesting. I found it, as I said, very formulaic. I found it standard Archerese, really, kind of almost airport literature, where you sort of pick it up. It was inoffensive in its own way. It was a checklist of Geoffrey's challenges through life, from prison, from dealing with business women, through all sorts of areas in every sense of the word, etc. And I suppose that classic line of the new conservative notion of ideologically new rich, the nouveau riche, what people actually do, the jealousies, the envies that work through that. I suppose, echoes really of Catherine Cookson, one might say, that sort of family
saga type.
Except Bristol as opposed to the North East.
Yeah.
That was the line for that. So, Jill, you have in many ways the casting view. I mean, obviously, the script was actually there. You said it was an enjoyable read. Any kind of key things you want to pick out that you thought were really pleasant and positive about the whole thing?
Well, I enjoyed it. I don't think it was one of those books where you just can't put it down. I wouldn't describe it as that. I did manage to put it down. Yeah. But I liked reading it. I enjoyed sometimes. I have to admit, there has been the occasional book that we've read that's been a struggle to get through. But this one wasn't. This was, I was quite happy to read it, and I enjoyed it. It was easy going. It was nothing too strenuous on the brain. It was a nice story. And he's very popular with the borrowers in Middlesbrough. Oh. So he's obviously got plenty of fans out there.
Must be worth pointing out, of course, that the borrowers aren't referring to those very small people that actually make it to the new Christmas special.
Middlesbrough Library borrowers.
Exactly. Yeah, a different line from that.
Yeah, I liked it.
Work through that. Well, that's great. I mean, you know, as you know, Jill, I never like to go on a negative side of things from this point of view. And just reading through the notion, Geoffrey Archer, of course, number one bestseller in fiction 15 times, 4 times bestseller for short stories, and, of course, bestseller for non-fiction in The Prison Diaries. Yeah, hats off for the fact that he's clearly managed to not only identify a niche in the market, but to actually fill that niche very effectively. I think, you know, it's certainly written with one eye on to the TV adaptation, the television work, etc. Whom would you see taking on board the role, for instance, of Hugo Barrington?
Oh, well, Hugo was a nasty piece of work, wasn't he? Oh, I can't think of anyone so horrible.
you wouldn't see possibly a Richard E. Grant maybe sort of taking on board that line?
No,
so
I don't think
Christopher Eccleston, perhaps?
Yeah, possibly.
I just thought maybe somebody else who actually comes through. And what about the boy with the marvellous voice and the line from that
Harry?
Play? Yeah. I don't think Daniel Radcliffe will want to go back to being another Harry. Actually, in fact, I can't see it at all. Rupert Grint, perhaps. I mean, they've got to do something now. The Potter franchise has come to an end.
I think
that might be a sort of possibility from that point of view. And actually, Rupert might, you know, for his latter years, be quite a useful one from that point of view.
Possibly.
And old Ted? No, the old soak.
Jack Tar.
Jack Tar, there we are. Exactly. Any sort of thoughts on Jack Tar? Now, we're trying to help Geoffrey out here, really, in terms of these are possibilities you should consider on this particular basis. So, is Peter O'Toole still going? That might be a possibility.
Maybe.
Or perhaps, you know, we should actually go for Ian McKellen. I think Ian McKellen should be in there in some way, shape or form.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I couldn't decide whether I liked the mum or not. Everyone kept saying what a martyr she was for working so hard to keep in the school, but it depends on what she was doing.
Well, I mean, you know, clearly, I thought she obviously, the description of her in the somewhat shady nightclub after Halfing was...
she let me down there.
Did it? Oh, Jill, please, you know. Girl's got to do what a girl's got to do.
But it was quite good that each chapter was told from a different character's point of view, so you did get to know each character quite well.
I thought it was quite interesting because clearly when we looked at the Fat Years, our Chinese author used exactly the same technique. And I was going to really just raise the point, and I will now in any case, you know, I wonder how this would translate into Chinese. And the similar sort of line, because it is exactly the same notion of it's the narrative is actually being driven by the characters that take a particular part to play, from Hugo, from Jack, from Maisie, and so on. And I think that's really quite an interesting even Hugo Barrington, because the style is exactly the same. Maybe our Japanese author actually got the idea from Geoffrey Archer, heaven forfend.
Yeah, I don't think in the Fat Years, though, we did get to know the characters as well in there. It didn't seem to
It allowed for much more ideological preaching at the end, really.
That
might come, of course. Geoffrey might have that all in standby for the sins of the father.
The next one. You know? Well, I think there's more than... There's going to be a few.
I have a feeling
two or three, maybe.
As we're talking about volume two of the Clifton Chronicles.
I think there could be a whole...
Yeah, if Downton Abbey actually is coming to the end. I think clearly Geoffrey has an eye on the Clifton Chronicles.
Yeah, and I think I probably will read them because I want to know what happens to poor Harry.
There we are. It's clear. I'm not sure that I'd say that, but again, ironic that obviously, is the notion of the author that the Clifton's named, of course, after the Clifton Bridge, which obviously locates it right in the middle of Bristol as well. So. Clifton Suspension Bridge. I think he does refer to it in the novel somewhere along the base.
I didn't think of that.
You see, that's okay. Bottom line, you know that Jill Paris went for eight.
Mm-hmm.
I went for the 7.5, one of my lowest numbers, it has to be said.
I
was down on that score, I'm afraid. So, Jill,
I'm going to go for eight because I quite liked it. I didn't love it, but I did like it.
Well, there we are. Much as people have said about Geoffrey Archer themselves, I'm sure. So what's the next book of the month that we have to look forward to? By Mary-Anne Schaffer and Annie Barrows, of course.
The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
Right. And as ever, we would welcome comments from our listeners to the podcasts of the Book of the Month. You can always email us info@southsideradio.com or get in touch with Middlesbrough Library Services directly, send us the line, etc. We're all for interactivity, aren't we, Jill?
Yes, we certainly are. And we're on Facebook, Middlesbrough Online Reading Group.
You might even have a text you might have written or you'd like us to review and put that forward. And I'm sure we would consider that because we
Definitely. Do
like local authors. And upcoming in 2012, we're already looking at a few exciting new authors, but old friends who are sort of in the region who will be producing some good stuff. So there we have it. I mean, it's almost like going back to old school, Jill. I think it's been years since the last time. I mean, I remember the very first one that we actually had, Shadowmancer. Was that the novel?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And we worked through that. Oh, and you see it. And I think the magic's still there. What say you? Yeah, exactly. You
know, yeah, we're still going strong.
Well, obviously, Rob Nichols.
Plenty more books in us yet.
precisely. Rob and our SOR friends and Jill Prowse will be back for others, etc. But it just goes to show, at the end of the day, you know, the Appleton Left Chute team keeps going. That's the thing.
Book of the Month. More than a podcast, greater than a radio show, quite simply an audio treat for the enlightened with Jill Appleton and Jill Prowse, and every so often, some extremely lovely writers.